Hey, everybody. Scott Burnside back for another edition of the Athletic Hockey Show. Two-man advantage. Pierre LeBrun joining from Toronto as always. Pierre, huge day for us. Got tons of news to talk about. And the legendary Bob McKenzie going to join us today. I'm pretty pumped.
Bob Father.
That's it, exactly. I got up early. Did some, I worked out a little bit, trying to get in shape for when Bob comes
on. Oh, come on.
Yeah, all right. I didn't.
You're into yoga these days, though. I'm proud of you. That's awesome.
Twice a week. I'm pretty limber these days. There's no doubt about that. We'll have some questions later in the show. Ask the dorks, as per usual. There's a ton of news to get to this morning. So let me ask you this. Where would you like to start? Great piece by you on Daryl Sutter and his return to the Calgary Flames. They will play their first game under their new old head coach, Daryl Sutter, on Thursday night against the Habs. What about the ESPN deal? I seem to remember that that broadcasting company. I had to look them up, but yeah, it seems like they're a reputable deal. But I know you guys talked about it on Insider Trading, and our good pal Frank Saravalli had some of the details. Looks like a 7-year deal that could be announced as early as today. 4 cups between 22 and 28 and upwards of 1,100 games, which I did the math, almost 170 games per year, about 165 games per year on average over the course of 7 years. Where do you want to start? You pick. Let's go.
Yeah, where was this when we were writing there,
Well, you know what it is? They say all the money they saved from icing us, they've now put towards the broadcast deal with the NHL. So, and it, yeah, it really...
No, good, really good news, I think, for our American friends, And by the way, I think NBC's done a terrific job over the past decade, so it's not a slight on them at all, but... You know, it still is a fact that when I was at ESPN 9 years, you were there, what, 13, 14 years, Scotty?
13 years.
Yeah, 13 years. Got treated so well. I mean, I had nothing but fond memories from my time there. Okay. But the fact remains that it shuts an institution, and you walk into an airport lounge, you walk into a restaurant, bar, you name it, anywhere in the United States, that's the channel that's on, regardless of the programming. I mean, it's just, that's the power of ESPN 24/7. And I think for the NHL to be back on that screen is huge. And, it just goes to show, it was, from all accounts, kind of a bitter divorce years and years ago. But, a lot of time has passed, and this was smart of the league to try to get back into it, and good for ESPN, which has bigger properties, let's be honest, especially the NFL, but to want to have hockey back, that's tremendous.
Yeah, well, and I mean, your point's a good one. Yeah, we joke about it a little bit, but from being there as long as you were, that there were so many people within the organization that are true hockey people, like and how many times town hall meetings, when are we getting hockey back? It's right. Not something, I think there's this narrative that ESPN, no one cares about hockey there. And that's simply not the case. And in fact, Steve Levy and I traded texts this morning, suggested maybe getting the band back together again. But anyway,
so. I texted with Steve last night as well. And I'm super happy for him. I mean, John Bucci,
Barry Melrose.
Yeah, Barry, Linda Cohen. I mean, all those people that remain loyal to the sport, even though they didn't have the sport to broadcast for so many years. I'm happy for all those people.
Yeah. Let's move on then. Daryl Sutter. Hey, what's interesting? I don't know if you remember, we got a question last week about what was going on with Jeff Ward and the Flames. And
right.
The questioner had mentioned Daryl Sutter. And lo and behold, he returns from... I think it was, his place is out near Red Deer, his farm. And I loved your piece. You talked to Dean Lombardi, who, of course, brought him to Los Angeles. A similar kind of thing, right? Daryl had been away
almost 10 years ago, December 2011. I have to go back and look at when that happened. Yeah.
Right. And here's the thing. I remember that I remember distinctly being at ESPN going, oh my God, really? That's the best the Kings can do, right? Like to recycle, because Daryl had been away from the game for some time when Dean Lombardi tapped him to come in and take over for Terry Murray, I believe. In Los Angeles, and I to me it was like, oh really, and of course 2 cups, trip to the Western Conference Final, and really such a catalyst to to what happened in Los Angeles and making it a destination spot for free agents and all that kind of stuff. Were you surprised when the word came out that Brad Treliving had decided that they were going back to a guy who was so familiar to that team, coached them to within one win of a Stanley Cup in 2004? What was your first take on that?
So yes and no on the surprise factor. Yes, because as I mentioned last week, you know, the Flames, Brad Treliving had waited a long time before committing to Jeff Ward in the offseason to remove the interim tag. And I just felt that, well, you know, he must have really investigated that decision. And so you got to give him a year if you're doing that. I mean, it's not like the day after the playoffs ended that they removed the interim tag for Jeff Ward. I mean, Brad Treliving took quite a while to get to that decision. So I felt based on that, that he probably owed Jeff Ward the rest of the year. On the other hand, not surprised, because one of the reasons why the decision on Jeff Ward was kind of delayed in the offseason, Scotty, I had heard rumblings that I wasn't in a position to report, but I had heard at some level, and I sort of filed that away, that Daryl Sutter was mentioned internally as an option back in the offseason. So, you know, when you know that and you file that away and then this happens, you're like, ah, okay. So they went back to it. And, I think this is going to be really good. I mean, Daryl Sutter's track record in straightening out a team is pretty significant. The stories that I, you know, the comments I got from Jared Stoll and Justin Williams about playing for Daryl in LA, I obviously interviewed them separately, Scotty, and they both ended up going to a place where it was like he ends up, you know, you end up pushing yourself to a level that you didn't think you had. That's what both players said about Daryl Sutter, which is interesting. And so now that's the challenge for him. And they had a heck of a first practice, by all accounts, on Tuesday in Calgary.
Yeah, a lot of skating.
And so... You know, the easiest way to summarize playing for Daryl Sutter, I think, is you're either all pulling on the same rope or you're out. And so let's find out now. You know, there's been some inconsistent play at times from Johnny Goudreau, from Sean Monahan, from other top players. Better get in line now. No question about it.
You and I chatted a little bit yesterday, just in general about, you know, you mentioned it's been 10 years, right, since Daryl Sutter came in. A decade passes. We have had moments of reckoning in terms of the coaching world. How do coaches relate to players? Where is the line? What is acceptable? What's unacceptable? And I'm not suggesting that, you know, where Daryl might have stood on that line a decade ago, but how do you think that transition's going to be for Daryl Sutter? Can he just be the same guy he was in L.A.? Or do you think he's going to have to find a different line for himself, given the sensitivities? And I don't mean that in a negative thing, but just I think people are more aware of, well, wait a minute, you can't say that to a person. You can't do that to a person if you're a coach, all those kinds of things. How much adjustment do you think will have to be done by Daryl Sutter on this?
Yeah, I asked that question in my article, and because I think it's – you have to ask it for any coach coaching today. I mean – I got to think Joel Quenneville and the amazing success he's having in Florida right now is probably a bit of a softer touch now than he was 15 years ago, right? I mean, all these veteran coaches right now that are still in the game. And I think for Daryl Sutter, we know from talking to players over the years, you know, there's the odd sarcastic jab that he could be cutting. He tries to make his point at times with players. And I think, you know, in today's kindler, gentler world, I think you'll have to rein that in a bit. But at the end of the day, there still is place in the game, I think, for some tough love. It just has to be done with respect, I think, and trust and so on. So, you know, I think he'll find that line. It's just that the line has moved from a decade ago, no question about it.
Yeah. Another thing that came up this week, and I know you've been following it, the whole notion of when the draft will happen, will it be moved, will they run two back-to-back next offseason, all those things, does look like it's going to stay where it was originally scheduled in July after this season gets done. And some discussion about the draft lottery. I have to tell you, I became infuriated when I was reading about the potential changes to the draft lottery and the tinkering on which teams can get move up or move down and who could be in the top two spots. And I have to tell you, it enrages me when I look at this and I'm like, why do we need to make this so complicated? It's like GMs want it. They want it all, right? You don't want teams to tank, but you want your bad teams to get a good pick. And to me, I feel that they've made it so complicated, or they're headed down that road where it's so complicated and it's already complicated that it's like, to what end? Like, you basically are going to alienate 90% of your fans who won't be able to understand what's going on in terms of the lottery. Anyway, that's my rant on. I hate that.
I did not have the same effect on me. I was sort of indifferent, quite frankly. I think I wrote about the potential draft lottery changes, I think, about a month ago. And so we finally got them. Although we should note that the memo that the league sent the governors and the ensuing conversation they had about it on Monday's Board of Governors call, there was no vote taken on it. So,
yeah,
I mean, I think it's where it's headed because the league doesn't draft memos for the heck of it. But I guess it's still TBD. As I wrote a month ago, Detroit going into that lottery last summer, clearly the worst team in the league in an organic rebuild. And I use that word on purpose, organic. They're not tanking. They were 25 straight years in the playoffs and have paid the price by having zero in their system, right? So they're going through a real rebuild after trying to win forever. And they did win, of course, a bunch of titles. It did not sit well with a lot of people who were neutral in this. Forget the Red Wings. I mean, obviously, you know, it's hard for them not to be biased. But other people on the sidelines have told me, that was the tipping point, that Detroit goes into that lottery and you know pretty much they're going to pick fourth. That doesn't make sense. Like, they should have a better shot at the first pick. And so I'm okay with the changes based on that. You know, the fact that we're going from, if this goes through, from 16 to 11 teams that can win the lottery, etc., that'll help the bottom basement teams a bit. I will say I was surprised at the recommendation of a team only being able to win the lottery twice over a five-year period. First of all, that's something David Boyle brought on at the table, as you know, a decade ago at the GM meetings in Florida, based on the Oilers winning the lottery all the time back then. Yep. And it never really got favor. And I'm surprised that it finally has, because I never got the sense that Gary Bettman liked the idea. So that's interesting to me that found its way in, but not the other one. I mean, I think, yes, you want to avoid tanking, but at some point you can't penalize a team like Detroit that actually does need help and needs help for legitimate reasons.
Yeah, I don't know. It just seems like you're splitting it and making it more complicated than it needs to be. I mean, okay, then if that's the case, then just go back to it. And if you finish 32nd, starting next year, of course, in Seattle, if you're 32nd, then you get the first pick. Then, you know, and now you're okay, well, we don't want everyone who misses the playoffs to have a shot at it, so we'll cut it back. Now it'll be 11. And boy, you can't do it. You can't be in the top two, or you can't win a lottery twice in 5 years. Like, who?
All right. Calm down.
Honestly,
you're upset. You're upset because you still live in Atlanta after all these years, and the Thrashers, you know, the Thrashers 1 year didn't have a great pick at first overall. Is that what this is about?
Yeah. No, it's not. It has nothing to do with Patrick Stefan or anything like that. I just think, you know what? I don't know if you remember this, and I don't think Ron Hextall would mind because, you know what, it was a long time ago. You and I were walking in Buffalo at the draft, I think. And we were actually walking toward we were going out to dinner, and we ran into Ron Hextall. We were talking about the draft lottery, and it might have been the year that Dallas moved up to three.
Drafted Heiskanen.
Heiskanen. Yeah. But I just remember it was a very casual conversation, and Ron was in Philly, and he was like, you know what? I honestly would be okay with, if you miss the playoffs, then all those teams go into the hat. You draft, you know, you just pull them out. No weighted to it. Just if you miss, you're all in the same boat and you get the same chance as winning it. Now, you know, like I just think, I don't know. It just makes me angry that the league will make this so complicated that they will alienate a huge portion of their fan base who won't under he won't be able to actively say, oh, this is good for us. Well, wait a minute. No, we had a first pick, or no, was that 2-6 years? I just think it's too complicated. Make it simple. All right. I'm literally standing up now.
Let's talk about it with our guest, Bob McKenzie.
All right. I'm all for that.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, everybody. As promised, joined now by Robert Malcolmson McKenzie. Bob McKenzie. I hope that's right in Wikipedia. I hope that's actually your given full name, Bobby.
That's it. You got it. Robert Malcolmson McKenzie.
See, you know what? It sounds like someone who could have been the footman for Sir John A. Macdonald back in the 1860s or a lord or something like that. Tell us the origins of Robert Malcolmson McKenzie. How'd that happen?
Well, Robert, I was easy because my dad was a Robert and he decided to go... and his dad was a Robert too. So I'm not doing the Robert McKenzie the third thing, but nevertheless, here we are. Malcolmson was my grandmother from Ireland, her maiden name. And in fact, I share it with there's a far more famous Malcolmson than me. You ever watch Ray Donovan?
Yes, of course.
Okay. You know his wife, Abby?
Yeah.
Her name is Paula Malcolmson. And she's my second cousin.
I think you told me this once, Bob. You're right.
Yeah. She's quite an actress. She's in Deadwood too. Have you ever seen Deadwood? Yes. What a fantastic show that is.
Yes. That's how
sweet. Anyways, her grandfather and my grandmother were brother and sister, and I've never met her, and she wouldn't have a clue who I am. And nevertheless, we share the same name. So anyways, there's the family history. Robert for my dad, Malcolmson for my mom's side of the family, and my dad's surname was McKenzie.
Well, she should know who you are. You got more Twitter followers than her, Bob. But you know,
I don't think she's even got a Twitter.
Thanks for joining us. And earlier in the show here, Scotty got on quite a rant about the potential draft lottery changes that.
Yeah, I heard the tail end of that.
I'm okay now. I'm sitting down, by the way. I calmed down.
And I should note, again, that the memo that went out Monday that we all read, but the Board of Governors actually didn't vote on it Monday, so I guess it's TBD. But as Bob knows, and Scotty knows, normally when a memo goes out, it's got about a 90% chance of eventually happening. Yeah. I'm wondering what your take is on it, Bob.
Well, yeah, you're right. The executive committee has recommended approval of this. When the executive committee recommends something, it almost always, I think the number is probably higher than 90%. The NHL is not in the habit of putting things down on paper that can get into the public domain, which this obviously did, and then turning around and saying, oh yeah, you know, a bunch of teams didn't like it, so we're not going to do it. That would be highly unusual. So as I break it down here, and you have to bear with me here because I'm semi-retired now and I'm a lot slower than I used to be. The first salient point is that the draft lottery is only for the first two spots in the draft, not the first three. We'll call that the Detroit Red Wing rule, because the Red Wings, of course, were the worst team last year. Mm-hmm. They had the first overall pick going into the lottery in a bizarre year where, you know, a lot of other things happened with the pandemic. They ended up picking fourth, and teams that were, you know, virtually were playoff teams when the pandemic hit a year ago now, as a matter of fact.
Right.
You know, Detroit dropped so far out of the mix that, you know, in what was perceived at the time, and it's, again, these things are wrong a lot of the times, but it was perceived as a three-player draft at the elite level at the top. But in any case, so that's the Detroit Red Wing rule. I'm fine with that. I don't have a big problem. And I honestly, and I said this before, when the NHL was fooling around with their draft lottery for the return to play. I said that they should not put all three spots up for grabs. It should only be the first spot up for grabs, right, because a team like Detroit had earned that low standing. Now, the next one is, while all non-playoff teams continue to participate in the draft, the maximum move-up should be limited to 10 selections. So all they're doing there is ensuring that those four or five teams, or two or three or four teams that were right on the cusp of making the playoffs,
can't win.
You know, they're point out. They're not getting the first or second overall pick.
Yeah,
I don't have a problem.
That's the 16-11 rule, right? That's the
the
new threshold.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the one that Scotty's probably upset about, if I heard him correctly, is no single club should be permitted to advance in the draft order by winning the draft lottery more than two times in a 5-year period. We're going to call this the New York Ranger rule because the Rangers, of course, got Capo Caco at two and Alexi Lafreniere at number one. And again, last year was a bizarro year with the pandemic and what have you. So I don't have a big problem. I understand the motivation for all that they're doing here to try and tweak things just a little bit. Some people would say that the pendulum needed to swing back a little bit the other way, that the league made it, you know, too restrictive for teams, and teams like Detroit, you know, who ended up going from 1-4 in last year's lottery. So I, you know, the rules are the rules and we'll all adapt. The only thing that makes me pause a little bit is none of this would take effect until 2022. So I guess they don't want to do something in midstream, but I kind of would have liked to have seen it maybe for this year even.
Right. And I actually call that rule a David Poile rule, Bobby, for all the times we went to the March GM meetings. And you remember that David Poile had tabled this years and years ago, the limitation of teams winning the lottery in a certain amount of time. And he could never get the room to support him. But here we are finally. And ironically, Nashville may not want a limitation on who can win the lottery over the next half decade. But there you go. And of course, the draft itself, nothing official yet, Bob. But we saw Dregs tweet this yesterday. And, you know, I traded some emails with a leak source who said it's not official yet, but all signs pointing to the draft staying put, which, I mean, you and I had talked offline, Bob, throughout all this. I think you and I are of the same mind from the get-go. I was dubious. I knew that there were people trying and GMs were trying and other, you know, people in the game. I just thought it was too much heavy lifting in my mind that the draft would ever move.
Yeah, I'm not going to say that this was a shell game or anything because I don't believe that would be accurate. But, you know, when I was at the World Juniors, in the bubble in Edmonton at the World Juniors, I talked to a dozen general managers and got all the details. You know, Kenny Hall and Julien Brisebois in particular were two GMs, one on each side of the border, that were really driving hard to defer the draft and had all sorts of ideas. And then everybody had all sorts of different ideas on how it should work and all of that. So I knew the GMs were absolutely passionate about this and they wanted to get it done. And they created a huge groundswell of momentum within their ranks to go to the league and say, you got to do something about this. We don't want to draft at the end of July. Make it December or January, or make it a full year later, but do not make us draft kids. It's not fair. And we don't want to do it. And while there was some empathy on the part of the league, I think the executive branch, as I like to call it, Gary mm-hmm. Bettman and Bill Daly, I mean, at the end of the day, they're lawyers. And the draft is a highly legal process in the sense that it has to be collectively bargained. It's not a legal entity with antitrust and everything else unless the Players Association agrees to it. And so anything that gets done to the draft has to be done with the blessing of the PA. And the minute you get the PA involved in something like that, it makes it that much more complicated. And I mean, it's all well and good. And I understand why the general managers felt the way they did, but they're saying, okay, we're going to do the draft. We're going to do the 2021 draft in June of 2022. Well, if I'm Owen Power, the potential number one overall pick, or his representatives, CAA, well, I'm like, whoa, time out here, guys. Wait a second. I might want to play in the National Hockey League next year. I'm 18 years old. How can you stop me from playing in the National Hockey League? I have a legal right, to go and gain employment with you in the National Hockey League. Why are you locking your door to me? And that would just be one example. And I'm not saying he would have done that. I'm just using him as a potential example. So the legal ramifications might have been significant on this one. And I just thought right from the get-go that as much as the managers wanted to change it. And the other thing anecdotally was I talked to a lot of the head scouts for different teams. And yeah, some of them wanted to defer. But a lot of the scouts I talked to said, you know what? I'm ready to draft right now if you want to know the truth. We've watched a lot of video on a lot of players. Yeah, some of the Ontario kids haven't gotten as good a look as they would otherwise. It's a level playing field for all 32 teams, I guess it is now, because Seattle's in this. Seattle's going to be in this one. And so I thought from the get-go that I was real dubious about the whole defer the draft movement.
Mm-hmm. Bobby, just as a follow-up before we move on from that, but you have such a sense of that entire part of the machinery of hockey with the young players and the scouting and the drafting. What challenges, like, do you think it creates an advantage for some teams that are exceptional at scouting? Like, do you see this as an opportunity for some teams to really, you know, sort of capitalize on an unprecedented situation without being able to see a lot of live hockey, and maybe the teams that have, you know, better scouts or have a better system or whatever, that they might be able to procure better talent in a draft like this in July than might otherwise be the case? Or what do you think the landscape looks like because it is so unusual?
I don't know that it would necessarily enhance anything other than, I mean, teams that have their act together have their act together. Teams that don't. And whether you're in-person viewing with a normal traditional draft or this pandemic version of the draft, whatever it's going to look like, I think it's a universality to it. If you're good at your job, you're good at your job. And if you're not, you're not. And I suppose you could argue that this would only amplify who's good and who's bad at their jobs. But the reality too is, I mean, this is one where, you know, budget teams that maybe don't have as many scouts should still be able to do as much or more scouting than anybody else, because so much of it is being done by video. And the key is to get access to a lot of that video. And I'm sure there are some teams that are better at that than others. I do believe a lot of the scouts I talked to said they're locked and loaded and ready to draft. And in fairness, most of the kids from major junior hockey that haven't been playing this year, a lot of the high profile ones anyways, have been playing in Europe this season.
Bob, let's shift gears. I know a lot of people in my life will ask me from time to time, how's Bob McKenzie doing? Because they don't see you as often now on TSN. You're in semi-retirement. We do see you every Wednesday on NBC because that was still part of that deal, right? And so what has your day-to-day been like, if you could tell our listeners, for Bob McKenzie?
Well, it's been pretty good, to be honest with you. Well, it's been a weird year for everybody for obvious reasons. My level of weirdness is mostly positive because I have had more time, but it was busy. I mean, you know, I think I sort of, my semi-retirement date was August 10th or thereabouts. That was, I think, the day of the draft lottery last August. And I kind of shut it down after that, but then I had to do the draft for NBC and related stuff for TSN, whenever that was, September or whatever. Late September, early October. October.
5-6, I think.
Early October. So, you know, then, from a personal point of view, I had Everyday Hockey Heroes Volume 2 came out. And so there was a huge amount of virtual promotion that needed to be done regarding that. So for basically all of November and the first part of December, I was selling books to, like, it was my job, which it was. And then, you know, the World Juniors cranked up and went to the bubble in Edmonton, but the preparation for that started before that. So November and December were actually like really busy, even though I wasn't doing my day-to-day stuff for TSN anymore. And then as soon as the World Juniors were over, I came down to Florida. I've got a home in Florida, and I've been down here since January the 11th. And it also afforded me the opportunity to fulfill my final year of my contract with NBC, as you said, Pierre. Mm-hmm. So every Tuesday night, I leave the Fort Myers airport. I go to JFK, come up to Stamford, Connecticut, where I am today, do my thing on Wednesday night with NBC. And first thing Thursday morning, I'm right back to Fun and Sun. And so for January, February, and now March, I've been golfing at least couple of times a week, sometimes three times a week. I've been riding my bike down to the Gulf of Mexico and walking the beach. It's been, I miss friends and family a lot, but it's been a pretty nice mix of work and fun and relaxation. And I'm 2 weeks away from coming home because I've got to get my quarantine in, and so I can join you, Pierre, on the trade deadline day, whatever that's going to look like.
Yeah.
Some other stuff for TSN. So this has been an unusual year too, because as I said, I still had my NBC duties, but I've only got them for this Wednesday, today, next week, and the week after, and then Dregs will finish up the rest of the regular season for NBC virtually. And I'll finish up my TSN stuff. I got some draft rankings I got to do here in April. Now that we know the draft is almost certainly going to be at the end of July, we're going to get our TSN midseason draft rankings done. And then after that's done, and I got a handful of Leaf regional games I'll do before the end of the regular season in May. And then I would say once the playoffs begin, I'll be up at the cottage and riding my bike and on my pontoon boat and tweeting pictures of wine.
Well, sorry, guys, I just got to jump in because the segue is too perfect. But I played a couple of rounds of golf with Bob over the past year, or last summer / fall, I guess. And your game has come a long way, man. You're digging in on one of your new passions for sure. It shows in your game. But I have to mention this because the last time Scotty was at my cottage a couple of years ago, pre-pandemic, I'm not boasting. I'm just pointing that it was a difficult night for him at the shuffleboard table in my cottage. And and I have to say that obviously since I own the board, I tend to do okay on my own shuffleboard. I'd be embarrassing if I didn't. But there was a guest who beat me last year, and that was Bob McKenzie.
Wow.
He dethroned me on my shuffleboard. It has to be said. It has to be announced. So it pains me to admit that, Bob, I have to tell you.
Well, I had a good partner, and yours was a little suspect that night, as I remember.
That is true. I wasn't going to mention that, but
yeah. What's that? So I'm curious, Bob, Pierre and I were talking about this yesterday, actually, that it was literally a year ago today. I was at my parents' home in Norwood, Ontario. I'd had to help my dad with some health issues.
Or tomorrow, again. It was March 11th, I think, Scott.
March 11th. But yeah. By day, on a Wednesday morning, I believe.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you want to quibble with the actual day, maybe it was 364 days, Pierre, but that's, let's call it a year, that you were on the podcast with Pierre and I, Bob, and we were talking about, if I recall correctly, that, sort of the landscape, and we weren't sure what was going to happen. And of course, it was a day later that the pause began, and this whole year, of course, started to unfold. And I wonder, when you think about this year and you think about the game and where it's headed, do you have a sense of optimism? Are there things you're concerned about, or you're like, wow, geez, I wonder how this will happen, as we move forward, given that we are now almost exactly a year into this?
Well, first off, I'll attack this from two directions. First one is just a recollection. And you're right. I mean, a year ago right now, I remember it all so clearly. We were in, if you remember, Pierre, the general manager's meetings were
that was like the week before we were in Boca, right?
Yeah. And so that I was so sick. I went to the general manager's meetings from my home in Naples, drove over. I was sick as a dog. Mm-hmm. I got to my room and I literally couldn't get out of bed, and I stayed in bed for like 18 hours or 16 hours, got up, realized I can't cover this. And I drove back. I was terrified at the time that, you know, maybe I had COVID. Right. And as it turned out, I didn't, but you know, a week later I came home and still wasn't feeling tremendous. And that was the, basically the day that, you know, the NBA day would have been
the 11th, roughly, the night of the 11th, yeah. I think. Right.
The 11th. And so I, when I got home, I made an appointment with my doctor, you know, and went and got checked out, and he sent me to hook me up with public health. And the day the NHL season got paused, that Thursday where you guys were on the air all day, I was on my way in when I had to go to my doctor's appointment, and the public health said probably not a good idea to be around right. people. And right. so I went right back home. And the next day I got a COVID test, which was negative. It took two or three or four days to get the result, but all that was happening a year ago right now. And it's hard to believe the year's gone by. Now, as far as just the year and hockey and the NHL and everything else, I try to be really optimistic. But I don't know how you can gild the lily and suggest that there's not going to be far-reaching effects for a really long time. Economically, I look at the owners, I look at the players, I just look at the game, and it's going to take so long financially, I think, to bounce back from this. And there's going to be a huge economic toll on the industry. And I think that's probably true. Forget about hockey for a minute. Forget about the NHL. You know, when governments are having to write checks for trillions of dollars in relief, you know, those bills are eventually going to have to be paid and come due to varying degrees. And I think we all stand the possibility of suffering from that. And there's been so many people, both physically, emotionally, mentally, financially, that have already, you know, paid huge costs over the past year because of the pandemic. You know, my son Mike's the general manager and head coach of the Kitchener Rangers. They now haven't played hockey for a year.
That's crazy.
You know, and I think of all those kids. I think of all the kids on that team and the OHL. And, you know, it's the only one of the three junior leagues in Canada that doesn't have right now a return to play set. And I think about all those kids. I think of those overage kids that are in their final year. I think about kids that are in their draft year that haven't had an opportunity to play. It's, you know, I think about the kids that are wanting to come into the league, the 15-year-olds who've played a little bit of hockey here and there, but, you know, and there will be an OHL draft, but it won't, you know, there's just so, you know, the lack of development that's gone on. And yet at the end of the day, you've still got to put it in its proper perspective. And these are all important things to kids and families and hockey fans and what have you. But at the end of the day, if you have your health right now, and you know, your family unit is good, then you count your blessings, because there's a lot of families that are looking back on this past year and aren't so fortunate.
Well, and I worry, one thing that I think we're all guilty of, and that's why once in a while I try to mention it, Bob, is that I worry too that for not just hockey players, but for any athlete, we kind of sugarcoat it. We kind of say, well, young athletes, you know, having COVID is like having a cough. You know, it's nothing for them. They have COVID, they come back 2 weeks later. But I do worry, because we don't know the science yet, you know, if there's any lasting effects for a lot of these athletes that we'll talk about in 6, 7, 8 years. So that weighs on me at times for sure. And you know, as far as the business of the game, I think about this all the time, but there's a double whammy of uncertainty, I think. One is so many people have lost their jobs and so many companies are hurting, that just because we're all going to be vaccinated doesn't necessarily mean everyone's ready to come back and reclaim their season tickets next year. Now, that's one thing I think about a lot. The other one is just psychologically, people who, even when we all get vaccinated, is it going to take time for people to be comfortable in crowds? Like, are they automatically going to want to sit in the room right. with 18,000 people? Yeah. And that's another thing I feel we don't talk about a lot, you know, from the mental health side of things. But we can't wait for the world to be normal again. But are we going to get normal? you know.
Yeah, well, there's going to be a new normal, and you're right, and you don't know exactly what that's going to look like. But I think, honestly, I think, and you're probably asking the wrong guy because I'm in Florida and I see people who are, quote, acting very normal, too normal right. for my life.
Yeah.
In a lot of instances. But nevertheless, you know, I do everything I can, you know, and, you know, I'm flying every week. So, you know, I don't love that, but it's part of my job. So I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. And you do everything to be as safe as you possibly can. And I take a lot of precautions, but you're right. You know, I don't know what the new normal is going to look like. And everybody's got a different perspective on it because some people will be able to mentally, physically, emotionally, financially bounce back like nothing happened. And then there's going to be other people who don't have the wherewithal to be able to, or the experience, or they've experienced something that won't allow them just to create a new normal that's really normal.
Now, I was talking to a CEO of an NHL team recently, and I think Scotty and I, you and I have talked about this, but on the flip side, you know, and I tend to be a more positive person, as you know, Bob, but he said, you know, Spanish flu 1919, if you want to look at history as a guide, what happened after the 1919 Spanish flu that killed so many people and made a lot of people sick? It was the Roaring Twenties, and people were able to finally get out of their homes after the Spanish flu. And I'll just say it, since we got a little liberty on our podcast here. People got drunk for 10 years in the 1920s, yeah. Basically. They were so excited to live life again and hit restaurants and bars and – and you know, listen.
Can we use that as our excuse now?
Well, I'm just saying.
What's the statute of limitations on the Spanish flu?
Well, hopefully it doesn't end up with prohibition, which is what happened at the end of the 1920s, too. But I mean, I love that anecdote that I got from this CEO because it was like, whoa, that's fun to think about. You know, are we all going to get over this after we're vaccinated? Though, you know, people that are. That feel good about how they got through it. And let's help the restaurant business. Let's help these people. Let's go to games. Let's go to concerts. I know you're a big music guy, Bob. I mean, so I like that. That's the other side of what I said earlier is the comforting part of it is maybe people can't wait to celebrate life again, you know?
Yeah. I think, you know, I think there's a whole bunch of people that can't wait. Just can't wait for the gloves to come off and the restraints to come off. And away we go. And then there'll be other people who are going to be scarred and they're not going to be so quick to do it. So as I said, it's as different as people are. So,
yeah, I can tell you that the gloves off group includes most of the hockey writers. But all right, Pierre, we're going to let Bob go in a second, but I wanted to close out this segment because both of you noted this in both in writing and social media and things like that, and I wanted to note the passing of Walter Gretzky in the past week. And Bob, we mentioned some of the your books that you have authored and a number of them, Everyday Hockey Heroes, both volumes of that, The Confessions of the Hockey Crazy Hockey Dad, Hockey Confidential, a lot of what you've written, it speaks to the, you know, sort of the fabric of the game and the people, the hockey dads and moms and uncles and aunts and brothers and sisters and on some levels everywhere. And maybe start with you, Bob. And I think we've often seen Walter is referred to as Canada's hockey dad. And it sometimes it's, you know, it seems like it's a bit of a throwaway line, but on some levels, I think it was absolutely true. And I wonder if you feel that his importance to the game, you know, how to quantify it, or how do you describe how important someone like Walter Gretzky was to the game of hockey?
Well, I think he was so important that, not unlike his son, Walter transcended the game. Walter Gretzky is bigger than hockey in Canada because of the kind of person that he was. And he was so kind and so compassionate and had time for so many people. And he impacted so many lives. And he did so much work, charity work, with, you know, the McDonald's School for the Blind in Brantford and yeah. On and on and on it goes. And you can't even quantify how much he did. And then just his individual interactions, he probably talked to more people than I can't imagine. There are very many Canadian men who have personally spoken to and had an interaction with more people than Walter Gretzky, more Canadians than Walter Gretzky. And everybody had stories. And so he wasn't just an iconic hockey figure. He became an iconic Canadian figure. And it kind of struck me as I was kind of put the whole thing in perspective that Walter Gretzky embodied all the traits that as Canadians we aspire to have. That kindness and generosity and caring and helping your neighbor and just, you know, leaving things in a better place than when you found them. And so for that, for me, Walter Gretzky is one of the greatest Canadians because he embodied all the characteristics that we all aspire to be on our best day. And he was like that every single day.
Yeah. And I think that humility that he always embodied totally transcended into Wayne, right, Bob? I mean, I've had some social evenings with Wayne over the years after an event, and you know, he's mobbed everywhere he goes, especially in our country. And he has never I've ever seen Wayne turn down an autograph for a fan, say hello. And I'm always like, oh my goodness, and it's genuine. And that, you know, and I think his parents, both Walter and Phyllis, had a big part in making Wayne that way.
Oh, no doubt. And what a lot of hockey fans today might not realize, because so many hockey fans today, you know, weren't around for when Wayne played. You have to understand that whatever Connor McDavid or Sidney Crosby or Alex Ovechkin or any of the modern day players are, even Mario to a degree, Wayne became so much bigger than the game. And Bobby Orr was the same way. He revolutionized the game. But I think in terms of the mainstream, you know, of sports in the United States and internationally, Wayne Gretzky, he transcended that to a greater degree than any other player. And on top of that, and the point I'm trying to make here is, to your point, Pierre, Wayne Gretzky was the single most accommodating hockey player with the media, with fans, with everybody. There are so many people who made so much money in the hockey world, in the hockey business, because of Wayne Gretzky. And all he ever did was give his time over and over and over again. And the reason he did it was twofold. One, because that's how Walter taught him to be giving. And number two, because he thought it was his responsibility as the iconic player in the game to do everything that he possibly could do to advance the cause of the game. And yet he'd said, you know, I always remember how times have changed, because it was the 91 Canada Cup. And it was, I think it was myself and Scotty Morrison and Al Strachan and a few other people. And it was after a practice for Team Canada at Maple Leaf Gardens. And like Wayne Gretzky, Mark Messier, and a couple of others were just sitting around in the dressing room with like four or five media people and just shooting the breeze. And like, you know, that never happens now. And yet that was just part of the routine back then, because the players like Wayne Gretzky were everyday men who just kind of approached their job in a way to sell the game and with that utter sense of humility.
Now, I know we got to go, but I have to ask, and I can't believe I've never asked you this, Bob, but a rather famous article that you wrote in the Toronto Star on the eve of Game 7 of the Leafs and Kings, did you ever hear from Walter about that article over the years? I'm curious.
No, I never did hear from Walter on that. I'm sure he was like the same as Wayne and everybody else was sour with the way I wrote it or whatever. But it was after Game 5 in Maple Leaf Gardens. And I always tell the famous story. I knew Wayne was really pissed off about what I wrote and thought it was disrespectful, I guess, but I didn't think it was, but nevertheless, we've gone over and over that. But I always famously remember it was a Saturday morning and I went to get my haircut. It was a Saturday morning of Game 7. and the Leafs and Kings were playing game seven that night. Winner goes to play Montreal in the cup final. And I went to get my hair cut, and the guy who cuts my hair was a huge Leafs fan. And he's going, "Oh, I can't believe the game's going to be great tonight." I said, "No, it's not. It's not. Your team's toast." And he goes, no, we're good. And I go, no. I said, why do you say that? I said, because Wayne Gretzky's really, really, really mad. and of course, Gretz played the greatest, he says, the greatest game he's ever played.
Yes.
That is glorious.
So legendary.
That's great. Bob, we could do this all day, but you do have, even though you're semi-retired, you actually have work to do. So it's such a great treat to catch up with you always. And I'm glad that we're going to bring this to a close, and we won't even have to mention an incident in Calgary at the orientation camp. See, I feel I've gotten off lucky, only having been savaged over my shuffleboard game.
Let's be clear when we say incident. That does not apply to me or Bob. So that leaves only one person on this podcast that the incident refers to.
Anyway, we'll catch up with that one some other time. But honestly, it's so good to catch up with you. I'm glad you're doing well. Enjoy Florida, travel safely, and I'm sure we will impose on you again. But thanks for coming to hang out with us.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Bottle Brunello coming your way.
All right, my friend, that was outstanding. We'll come back after a very brief break. We'll wrap up our chat with Bob McKenzie and take some questions and send you on our way.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I was listening to Bobby talk about all the things he's doing. That doesn't sound like semi-retirement to me. It sounds like a lot more work than semi-retirement. But you know what? Maybe he'll always be one of those guys because he's so intricately involved in the game on so many levels and has been for so many years. Maybe that's the way it'll always be. I kind of like that idea as opposed to, you know, the idea that he might be just sitting at his cottage making margaritas every day. So,
you know, he's always been a trendsetter, right? I mean, he was really in hockey. I don't want to speak for other sports because I think Peter Gammons in baseball was a trendsetter this way. But Bob was the first guy really in hockey media to, you know, go from print to television in such a smooth fashion, right? And for a long time do both, and then eventually obviously full time at TSN. But as you know, Scotty, that literally directly inspired my career choices the way that he did that. And but what I'm saying is now in semi retirement, he's kind of a trendsetter too, because I don't know about you, but I never really want to get disconnected from the game 100%. But there certainly come the time where I'll probably want to work less. So you know. Now, we don't all get the collar shot like Bob, but I'm hoping certainly that when the day comes and in a dozen years or whatever, that I still get to do something while certainly, you know, not putting in the same amount of time. I think it's pretty ingenious.
Yeah, no kidding. Just one of the best in the business, and there's a reason they call him the Bob Father. I want you to do some research and find out where that came
from. Oh, we forgot to ask him that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll get him next time. All right, we've got to take a couple of questions from our loyal listeners and readers. We've got a bunch of good ones. This will disappoint my friend Al in Ottawa, who sent in another question about our personal hygiene, which we won't be able to get to today. But this is a good one to start because I know you and I are both working on some pre-trade deadline stuff. From Jay at Account for Hockey. Hello, Scott and Pierre. Very polite. I was wondering, what is the likelihood that the Toronto Maple Leafs trade for Taylor Hall? He wouldn't have too far to go. He'd have to quarantine, but he'd just have to come across the border from Buffalo. Mm-hmm. And what is the likely acquisition cost? Thanks. What do you think?
I don't think it's that likely. I mean, listen, I'm never going to say never, but his AAV alone, I think, would make it too difficult for the Leafs. I mean, he's $8 million on the cap this year. if Buffalo does trade Taylor Hall, I think it's almost a foregone conclusion that they would eat half of that AAV to make him a $4 million player. But even at $4 million, you know, I think the Leafs, who are on the lookout for a forward that can play either on their second or third line, I was hearing from a couple of teams around the league that the Leafs were calling around saying, you know, a player with some skill, but also a bit of grit. So, but I think that player probably needs to make less than $4 million in my mind. So again, I'm not going to say never, but, and don't forget, Taylor Hall has a full no move. And interestingly, despite the year from hell in Buffalo, has repeated a few times this year that he'd like to actually re-sign with the Sabres. So I guess my point is he also decides his fate here. I mean, if he decides he wants to finish the year in Buffalo, that's his call.
All right, here's a related one. This is from Dan at DStens8. Please say something good about the future of the Buffalo Sabres that isn't about how nice their jerseys are. I like the jerseys. I'm okay with all that retro stuff. Fans need some optimism or hope. This question and our taping comes a day after they blew two goal leads and end up losing to Philadelphia.
Well, it doesn't matter now. Whether they win or lose.
I'm just giving some context.
Yeah. I'm going to give an answer that goes both ways here. And it's all about Terry and Kim Pegula, the owners. Okay? I think they're part of the problem with what's happened with the Sabres in the sense that I think there's been too often a change of direction from the top that has affected everything else beneath them. And so, you know, I've written this when Jason Botterill got fired. I don't know if Jason Botterill would have ended up being a good GM. I can't answer that. I'm not going to pretend that I'm ready to say he would have been. But how do you know after only 3 years? Like, they fired Tim Murray after 3 years. Tim Murray, who went out and traded for Ryan O'Reilly, traded for Robin Leonard. He was the GM when they drafted Eichel, which is a no-brainer. But my point is, he got fired after 3 years. Botterill gets fired after 3 years. And obviously, Botterill made some mistakes. You know, Jeff Skinner at the top. But if you keep, and I talked about this with another executive this week, and he said I was bang on, you keep changing your GM every 3 years, you're shooting yourself in the foot, because then you got to start over again. And so, you know, Kevin Adams is now the GM. He obviously didn't have any front office experience at the NHL level, although I believe he's a pretty smart guy. But is he well surrounded enough to make these decisions? You know, now, so that's all the negative stuff in terms of being directed at the Pegulas. On the other hand, the Pegulas own the Buffalo Bills. And that franchise is doing remarkable things right now in football. Same owners. So clearly it's in them to hire the right people and to get out of the way, because we've seen it on the football side. Now they need to do it on the hockey side.
And I think you hit the nail on the head. And, you know, I've known Kevin Adams a long time, covered him with the Leafs. And, you know, but he's in a very difficult spot, right? He's in the deep end, swimming with the Sharks now. And to me, it's about, you know, it's how he surrounds himself with people who can help him. And this, you don't get out of this mess on April 12th or July at the draft. And I know it's not great for Sabres fans, but this is going to take some time still. And to your point, at some point you just got to stand, you know, if you're ownership, you've got to trust that you have people, give them the resources they need to address the areas they need to address and let it take its course.
So here's what I would do if I was Kim and Terry Pegula. Mm-hmm. I would go out and try to hire Jim Rutherford this summer as president of hockey operations to come in and help grow Kevin Adams as GM, but also give him some guidance through these turbulent times. And it just, you know, Jim had Kevin Adams in Carolina in 06, right?
He did.
Yep. So there's an obvious link there in my mind. We know from the interview I did with Jim Rutherford recently that the idea of becoming a president of hockey operations appeals to him in the right spot. I think that would be a terrific spot in my mind.
Yeah, I agree. Oh, let's do two quick ones. One's an easy one here. This is from Mellenby's Dead Rat, Dale JH66, Scott Mellenby in the Florida Panthers, of course. Has the NHL said how they will seed the teams when they get to the Final Four? It's probably a good reminder for fans, because, of course, we don't We don't have the traditional East-West conference set up, which generally is how the Final Four get paired up.
Yes.
I'll leave that to you. Yes, go ahead.
By the way, if that question's from Mellonby's dead rat, then we're getting a question from a ghost. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And with
all
you.
All right. yeah, so what the league has decided is that they will seed the Final Four 1-4, 2-3 based on regular season standing. Right. So pretty simple. Now, hopefully everyone plays 56 games, which I think now, knock on wood, we seem to be over the hump with all these COVID cases, but you never know what's around the corner. But as long as everyone plays 56 games, then it's pretty simple. It's points in the standings and 1-4, 2-3, regardless of geography. Now, if we get some U.S. teams that don't play 56 games, then I guess points percentage would decide the four. But the league has told us that it's 1-4, 2-3 in the semis.
Right. So I was just looking if we went by just the top teams in each division. So that would be Tampa versus the Islanders in the one conference final. And
they're not conference finals. They're league semifinals.
League semifinals. Well, yes, sure. Yes. And then it would be Toronto, Vegas then in the other.
Ooh.
There you go. It's kind of cool.
Toronto playing out of Buffalo or out of Toronto by then? I guess we'll find out.
Ooh, I guess we will find out. Okay, final question for our day today. This comes from Dan's Hockey Cards at NHL EA Sports Pro. Do you think the Sens will be a playoff team within 3 years? I think this came up. There was some discussion to our good friend Mark Mathot in Ottawa talking about that.
He said the Senators will be better than the Leafs in 3 years, he said?
Yeah, I think 2 to 3 years,
knows?
He said.
Might be right.
I know.
I'm not ready to say he's definitely going to be right, but you can't dismiss it. I mean, I love these kids on Ottawa.
Yeah, so this is a bit broader. This isn't who will be better, Toronto or Ottawa, but this is, do you think the Sens will be a playoff team within 3 years? That's a realistic period of time, I think.
So can I answer that question while refraining from wanting to put in the caveat of as long as Eugene Melnyk doesn't interfere? Is that
I think you can. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you got this Jake Sanderson coming. I mean, I think Ottawa's, Formanton probably make the jump next year. I do think there'll be a playoff team. And again, I just hope that, the Senators have the lowest payroll in the league this year. I hope that Pierre Dorion will have the tools, the financial tools, to continue to build around what he has an amazing base of talent. Now he needs to make sure they can become a cap team here. Brady Tkachuk needs a second contract after this year, Scotty. What's that going to look like? So that would be my one caveat, is the always eternal financial struggles of that franchise. But with that aside, just purely based on what I'm seeing in the pipeline and what we're already seeing in Ottawa, yes, I think they will be a playoff team.
Yeah, I'm with you. I got to tell you, now I'm a bit soft because I've known DJ Smith since he was a captain of the Spitfires when I first started in sports. But I think he's going to be a very good coach. I think he's already learned a lot, even in the short time that he's been the head coach in Ottawa. I like the fit there, and I think the guys like to play for DJ. And yeah, I'm with you. I say yes. I say yes to that answer. All right, just about time here. What other pod info should we pass on today? How about this? Craig Custance and his full 60 this week. It's the Prospect Series. Always a good, goes back to our draft discussion with the Athletic's Corey Promman and Scott Wheeler. Those guys know their business. That's Thursday at the Athletic. And you should check out our comments section for each podcast episode at the Athletic app, and rate and subscribe to the Athletic Hockey Show on Apple. And if you aren't already a subscriber, go to theathletic.com/hockeyshow and receive a subscription for just $3.99 per month. My friend, you were outstanding today. Very good work by you.
Dude, I just take your lead. You're my big brother. I just do what you tell me, man.
You know that's not even true, right? Like, I mean,
do you like how I mentioned the shuffleboard at the cottage? Sorry, man.
I wonder. Well, before we go, who were the partners? Who, like, you got?
No, I can't. I can't. I can't reveal that. No, I can't reveal that. I'll tell you off air. No, it's,
I already know who it is.
Yeah, so. No, there's a couple of buddies, but right. You know, since Bob took a dig at my partner, I don't think we can reveal that.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe we'll get your partner on the podcast one day. All right, so that's good. Enough. All right, have a good day, pal. Take care.
Love you.